Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. Before I continue, on July 26th at 3 p.m., I'm hosting a Zoom history conference all about the 1913 Great White Hurricane that hit the Great Lakes. It's a really interesting story. It costs $5 to register for the 45-minute conference, or free for my patrons. And you can be a patron for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. And if you want to register for the conference, just go to CanadaEHX.com and click on Register. Today on the podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Stephen Kersner, the creator and person behind Ed the Sock. Ed the Sock is, well, I would say a television icon in Canada. A lot of people know exactly who Ed the Sock is. And as for myself, growing up in the 1990s, I was very familiar with Ed the Sock. And today, Ed the Sock isn't on much music anymore, but he is operating his own network called the FU Network. It's a very interesting podcast network. It has some excellent shows that I really enjoy, and he has a Twitter feed that is extremely popular. So let's just get to this interview and learn about Ed the Sock, politics today, and much more. So I guess what got you interested in politics? You had run for provincial office, I believe, in 1990. A lot to do with Ed the Sock right now is political focused. Where did that interest first come about?
Well, I guess I've never really examined that until this particular moment. It came about, I guess, as I've always felt. When I was in school, I was always the short kid with the big mouth, and got me into a lot of fights with people. I never lost one, even though there was often two against one, and I was smaller because I was more motivated. And I always felt like, obviously, fighting for the little guy was me, but I would also stand in for people who were being bullied by other bullies. And step up to fight that. I've always felt that people need some form of protection from the bullies in the world. Unfortunately, the early part of I never liked the idea of popular sentiment. I was always and still remain suspicious of popular sentiment. You know, the wisdom of the crowd, so to speak, which never is particularly wise. That manifested itself when I was younger as being somebody who was very much a Reagan Republican. Now, Republicans back then are not like Republicans now. I'll say in my defense, people say that Ronald Reagan today wouldn't be able to get elected as a Republican because he was too liberal, according to today's standards. But I didn't like the way everybody that I knew seemed to be, and I was in schools, of course, constantly being inundated with youthful passion, but they were always leaning towards being very, very left-wing, and I am always suspicious of anything that's that popular. And so I rejected it because I didn't think their ideas made sense, and I was very conservative. But it was always with the intention of conservatism being something that could be used to help people. You know, like the idea that social programs are good, but we have to find a way to pay them, otherwise they're going to run out and people are going to be left without. And unfortunately, that's kind of what happened, because we see that today where it's the government's fault. They cut taxes, and then they say that there's no money for services, and there would have been money for services if they hadn't cut taxes. But I was very involved politically. I was doing political talk shows. Also, there was probably a degree of youthful narcissism involved in that I thought that my opinion was an opinion that other people should have. So I did a lot of political programming as myself. I was recruited to run for the local Progressive Conservative Riding Association. I was all of 23 years old and knocked on thousands of doors. Didn't think we'd ever win because it was a very, very safe Liberal seat. And we didn't win, but the goal was to make sure we got enough vote to get our deposit back. Because if you don't get enough of the vote, you don't get the deposit back from Elections Canada, or Elections Ontario in this case, whatever it was. And we did. We got our deposit back. We increased our vote from the previous candidate. And I learned an awful lot of things about how politics really works and what the public is really thinking when you go knocking on the doors, how well-informed or not well-informed they are. I quit the PC party when Mike Harris got elected. And started candidate in office was demonizing single mothers and basically calling them all welfare frauds and so on. And even though during the campaign we were privy to internal polling, which showed that voter fraud, or that election, sorry, welfare fraud was less than 1%. So it really wasn't an issue. But I said in one meeting, I don't approve of them going after, you know, the weak and the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And then everyone turned on me and called me, oh, comrade, like as if I was some communist all of a sudden. And so I actually said, okay, it's been nice. And I left and I never went back. And since then, I have gone very much towards the center. I'm a small liberal. And, you know, it's funny because they say that if you're not a socialist when you're a teenager, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative when you're an adult, you have no brain. Well, apparently I've had neither heart nor brain because I was a conservative when I was younger, and as I got older, I became more liberal. So I fly in the face of that, and I don't wind up on the good end of the stick either way. But I also realized a long time ago with Ed that there was a tremendous amount that a character who is not human can do and can say, because mm-hmm. non-human characters can do and say things that human beings can't do. If South Park was with a bunch of young kid actors, it probably wouldn't even have been greenlit. But because they're animated, they are removed from the same considerations that people place on human beings. When a human being says something, trying to make a political point or a social point or something, there's an automatic pushback in people's psychology, which is, who the hell are you to tell me that? What makes you so much better than me that you can lecture me? But they don't feel that way about basically comedians, depending on how the comedian goes about it. They don't feel that way about cartoons. They don't feel that way about puppets. There's a relaxation factor there so that people are able to drop that rejection filter and perhaps absorb more. And the first season on City TV, when we moved from cable access to City TV, it was pretty much just a retread of what I did on cable access, even some of the same guests. And the second season, I determined I didn't want to do that anymore. And Married with Children was a very popular TV show at the time, which was sort of a slob comedy that was satirizing all the really, squeaky, clean family comedies of the time. But they had fallen into a trap whereby they had to keep upping the shock value. Rather than upping cleverness, they just upped shock value. And their shows became nothing more than excuses for more and more shock comedy, but there was no story anymore. And I thought, I don't want to go in that direction. So instead, we started doing stuff that was more political. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember very clearly the first show we did a thing about products that were rejected. And there was things like the Fisher-Price inner city American hospital. And there was like people out front dead because they didn't have insurance and stuff like that, like little toy figures. Mm-hmm. And we had a police billy club spray painted in colors of African flags, so that they can be more representative and to black people when they're beating them. And it was clumsy, but it was the first steps towards doing comedy that made a point and mm-hmm. made a difference. And we're told to stop doing it by the powers that be, and we just kept doing it, and it caught on. And when Ed was on Much Music, it was just a natural inclination to eventually use the character to speak truth to power and to call attention to things that were not right. And people responded to it because I think we did it in a particular way that didn't sound like it was moralizing so much as it sounded like Ed always did, which was the same tenor as making fun of boy bands and, you know, bullshit marketing and things like that I was now using to talk about issues. Mm-hmm. And people really responded to it. And we've just continued since then. And then when I decided that it was time to bring it back in a big way. It never really went away, maybe for like about a year, year and a half. But I was mostly doing stuff for American internet outlets and being paid in American dollars, which is always good because then you get more actual dollars when you're here. Then the election, even before the election, I think that things really started to gain traction during the SNC-Lavalin thing, where I thought that the public wasn't getting the real information. There was just a whole lot of focus on the sizzle and not on the steak, and that people were getting the wrong impression and they weren't able to make a proper assessment of what was going on because they were being told a lot of things and a lot of hyperbole and a lot of exaggeration. And I can't stand that. I want people to be able to make the right choice. If they decided that they still, you know, felt that Trudeau or his people had done the wrong thing, that's fine, but they should be able to make that choice based on actual facts, not on hyperbole. And unfortunately, the opposition was offering only lies and hyperbole and stretching the truth so thin that it was, might as well have been a lie. Mm-hmm. And that got traction with people. It got positive and negative response. And the negative response helped create more positive response. And it just kept building until, people were like, oh, you're a big shill for Trudeau. The truth was, no, this was not really about Trudeau. This was about people not being given the right information so they could make proper, proper judgments, so they could see things and make their own opinions. Because Ed has also defended Andrew Scheer at times, mm-hmm. and the press was reporting things that seemed to be completely exaggerating or leaving out context, and it defended other conservatives at times. Because it's more about defending the truth and saying the truth than it is about any individual or any particular political persuasion. During the election, it really gained traction, and because unfortunately the conservatives hung their hat on continuing to just tell things that were adjacent to or were completely inaccurate, and just pointing out where they were wrong, or where they were not saying things they should have said, in the sense of Scheer renouncing comments he had made about gay marriage and gay people, which were completely out of step with modern times. It wound up having tremendous traction, and from there it turned out that Ed can get a hashtag trending in the top 10 within 30 to 40 minutes, especially if it's something political. Mm-hmm. Though we got something stupid going, a fight between people who love butter tarts and people who hate them, and both hashtags were trending in the top 10 for 12 hours. But I think people listen to Ed because Ed has been consistent his entire career. As long as they've known him, Ed has just said things the way he sees them. And if it's based on information that later is shown to be wrong or new information comes out, fine to say that it was wrong before and this is the actual information. And people trust Ed because Ed mm-hmm. always says, when we, before the last provincial election, there was a advertising agency that did a focus group. And what people said about Ed was, A, we need Ed now more than ever, because there's so much crap out there, you need someone who you trust to cut through it. And they also said, Ed says what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. And so, in the time that Ed was, not prominent, nobody rose to take that position. I mean, maybe in a sense Rick Mercer did, but in a way that was so different that it wasn't the same. But they didn't have, a people's champion to say what they believe the truth to be based on the facts that they've received. And nobody was speaking for the little guy, and certainly not in media, because even though media is supposedly democratized in that everybody who's got a phone is now all of a sudden an international broadcaster or can be, in the mainstream media, nobody came forward and stepped up to take over what Ed had done before. And so it was just a pivot from taking shots at the deceptive marketing practices in the music business and taking shots instead at deceptive practices, among the political class.
Mm-hmm. You kind of touched on it, but what do you feel has led to the continued popularity of Ed?
I think, I did touch on it. I think it's that Ed is somebody they've known for, Ed started on City TV and Much Music in 1994. It was first on TV in 1987. But that was cable, cable access in a small cable station in northwest Toronto, the smallest one in the city. And then it grew to being a show, and having a late night show that was on across the country on cable access channels from 11:30 to midnight on Fridays. People have known Ed a long time, and they've seen Ed grow up, they've seen Ed evolve, and Ed to them is 100% real. And somebody they can trust, because Ed never sells out. Even when Ed would push a product or something, it's a product he believes in, and also people recognize somebody's got to pay for this stuff. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're not lying to consumers, they're fine with it. They know that advertising happens, and sometimes it's good to know about products and things. But Ed would also go on Much Music and very publicly refuse to read certain ads because he didn't believe in it, or they were so badly written he wouldn't touch it. And sometimes would call the vice president at home during his dinner without any warning and talk to him live on the air and say, this is crap, I'm not reading it. So I think people get a sense from Ed that they live vicariously. They wish they could say the things Ed says. And now more than ever, there's great restriction from both the right and the left on people expressing themselves, even expressing questions, even asking, you know, why this is this way or why people think that way. Asking the question has become a thought crime, because you should know and you shouldn't be questioning. You should just fall into line. Which team are you on? Are you on this team or that team? Because it's always, if you're not with us, you're against us these days. And if you, Ed gets crap from the left and the right, because each one at some point thought that Ed was on their team, and they don't realize Ed's on no one's team. Ed's on Team Truth, and sometimes that's falls to the left, and sometimes it falls to the right. It depends on what's actual fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just people, and also people have an affection for Ed, because Ed, they remember Ed from Much Music, and they remember Much Music very fondly. It was a time when the world made sense, and there was still the ability to talk and have and joke about things. Nowadays, you can't joke because someone said, that's not funny. It finds some little corner of the joke that they can use to blow up as it being about something that isn't funny, as opposed to what it's actually about, you know, looking at it on the surface. So, you know, there's that warm and fuzzy feeling when you think back to when Much Music was good, when it existed, because it doesn't even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
People remember that very fondly, which is, you know, one of the reasons we're resuscitating it with the FU Network and shortly with, you know, FU Music. And I've been in contact with Bell about purposing the Much Music Library as well for future things. I don't know if that's going to go anywhere. We've had a few meetings, but everything there is very, very corporate. It's a very different world than the one I live in. The world I live in is, I have an idea, let's do it. And that was the case with Much Music, too. I mean, Fromage, which many people remember Ed for, Ed didn't create it. But people don't even remember Fromage from before Ed was on it,
mm-hmm.
because it was a show that took shots at foreign videos and videos that were made with very low budgets, usually Canadian. And when it was actually kind of canceled, because the guy who produced it for years moved to another one of the channels in the building, and nobody was there to produce it. So my wife, Liana, and I decided to produce it on our own. And we did, it was 1999, we did the worst music videos of the century, and we watched the videos, we chose the videos, we edited them, we scripted it, put the whole thing together ourselves with Ed, and then just handed it in. And I remember the woman in charge, Denise Donlan, at the time said, what's this? And we said, it's Fromage. She said, I thought that was canceled. We said, well, I guess it isn't. And they ran it, and it did exceptionally well. It wound up being, dollar for dollar, their most successful series year after year after year in ratings and in dollars to production cost ratio. And that was just, you can't do that today. You can't go, you know, you can't have a national network where you just go in and start creating a program and then hand it in to them. You'll get fired. Trump Television was unique in that they had the balls to stand behind people and let them rattle cages and ruffle feathers and even make fun of them, because they understood that it only benefited them as far as people saying, this company must be cool to allow this stuff to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
When you're out in the street, when Ed's out, do you find a lot of people are stopping to talk to Ed because they recognize him, like you said, from Much Music, from CDTV, and things like that?
Oh, it's kind of insane. If we're somewhere and somebody asks for a picture with Ed, I say, you know, sure, and then we turn around and there's a lineup. All of a sudden, where did all these people come from all of a sudden? We're out somewhere, like, you know, at the protest at Queen's Park, cars are driving by honking and waving at Ed, and so on. So, yes, the short answer to that is yes. People are constantly, whenever they see Ed, they really want a picture, especially now with the selfie culture. Everybody wants a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, somebody said to me once, don't you find that annoying? I was like, no. I would be more upset if it didn't happen. Ed's there, and they're just like, huh? Well, oh, yeah, Ed. No, I'm glad that they get excited. I'm glad that it means something to them, because, you know, you do stuff on television. You don't really have an audience in front of you. It's not like theater or something like that. So you don't know what the nature of the impact you're having is, or if you're having any impact. And over the years, you know, had a woman who had a miscarriage and was in a deep depression. She told me she had been, and she said that she was flipping through the TV one night, and stopped and watched it, and then started laughing. And it was the laughter that broke her depression, that got her out of that line of thinking, mm-hmm. and brought her back from where she was. And when we were doing the live show, we did a live show last year across Canada, city to city to city, we're at one location, and a guy comes up to me, because not every location had a place you could, a green room you could be apart from everybody, and guy comes out of the bathroom, and he comes up to me, and he's the guy, I swear, like 6'7", and very burly, biker-type guy. And he says, you the guy who led the sock? I said, yeah. And he said, can I talk to you? I'm like, oh, shit, yeah, okay. He takes me aside and says, when I was a kid, I was always big and awkward, and I was sort of like an outsider. And watching Ed saying that outsiders are cool and don't do what everybody else does, you're better if you don't, that got me through difficult times in my teen years. And he said, and recently I was depressed, and then Ed was there again and talking about things on Twitter and doing videos. He says, you did it again. You pulled me out of a depression again. And then he pauses and he says, can I have a hug? And this big, scary biker-looking guy. And I said, sure. And he pulls me in like I'm a rag doll. But it's moments like that you realize that even though it's comedy, it's not frivolous. Mm-hmm. And somebody very high up in the Liberal Party campaign, we came to chat with each other online afterwards. And he said that Ed's social media was, in his words, quote, essential to the outcome of, what the outcome was in the election, mm-hmm. which I don't want to believe that's true. I don't want to believe that I understand people are turning to non-traditional sources now, that they're looking for sources to believe in because they don't trust the media. But I don't want to believe that that they're listening to a sock puppet and that changes the complexion of the vote in the country, certainly in Ontario. But this is what this person told me, and he's not one to just blow smoke up somebody's ass. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's both redeeming and you feel good, it's validating, but at the same time, it's a little bit scary when you recognize you can have that kind of impact. You got to be careful what you actually say.
Absolutely. Can you tell me a bit about what led you to podcasting and the FU network?
The FU network came before the podcasting. The idea was originally strictly videos, like doing video programming, video content, as they call it now, or as I call them, TV shows, because it's the same kind of idea. But it was just a number of people who would come up to me and say how much they missed Much Music. And I know, having worked there, that it was very special. And yes, there's tons of stuff on YouTube, but I've been digitizing a lot of Ed's old Much shows and, the VJ Flow stuff and VJ Shifts and so on, because I have the masters here. And I look at it, and there's things with Ed and Rick and Ed and Bradford and other people and just talking to people on the street. And there is really nothing that has that kind of snap to it that people are doing now. The stuff people are doing now, there's a tremendous undercurrent of, look at me, look at me, look at me. And that wasn't the undercurrent at Much Music. We really felt that we were more public servants than anything like that. Nobody had an attitude. Nobody ever copped an attitude. Nobody ever treated fans badly. We all just thought we were people just doing a job and entertaining people. None of us thought we were better than anybody else because we were doing it. And that really showed. It came through. There's this ephemeral quality that you can't really put your finger on, but it's there. And so people miss Much Music. They miss when times were simpler. They miss when entertainment reflected who they are, because it doesn't anymore. Much Music changed the way TV could look, could sound, could feel, and now that's all gone. And the stuff that's coming out is all very slick and corporate, and it's like Teflon. People can't grab onto it. Whereas, Much Music, there was a VJ that reflected, every portion of the population. Not so much in ethnicity, though there was that, but also in attitude and bearing and things like that. After I left, they started basically getting spokesmodel types and then telling them what to say. And we were never told what to say. They hired people who they trusted the people they hired to do the job and to be themselves. And we were never asked before we, went on the air live, what are you going to do? We never had to ask permission, never had to get anything cleared. We just did it. And you can sense that there's a legitimacy and authenticity to all of that. So I missed it. And then I was actually talking to Much Music when they were starting up something called Much Digital Studios, which I think is still around. I don't know. It didn't make the world, catch on. And I gave them ideas of what I thought it should be. And they decided to go in a completely different direction. And I thought, these are all good ideas. I'm going to do them. And the reason that people haven't been able to recreate much music and the people who came in after us couldn't keep it alive is because if you weren't there at the time, you don't know how what it was that made it work. And I just felt that it's not fair that younger people are deprived that form of media because stuff that people are doing on their own, it doesn't have any discipline. They don't necessarily know how to tell stories. There's a lot of self-indulgence in them. There's a lot of stuff that's funny to somebody and three of their friends, but isn't necessarily something that translates to other people. There's also no place for people to get that kind of training that you got from you know, being on a channel like Much Music, or that kind of experience, or that kind of people there to help mentor you. So that's what was really behind it all, is like, this really needs to happen. We initially, I spent time finding and recruiting people who did really good videos. And there was some really great content. The problem was all of the programs that, there was like three main ones that were the basis, and there was going to be Ed shows. They were all partnerships. There was always like either there was like three of them or there was two of them. And in one after the other, they all broke up for various reasons. There was a partner, there was a duo. One of them moved to the States to, he got engaged and married and lived in the States. So that was dead. Another one was a business where two of the partners left, and they were the ones who did all the video stuff. So it was sort of like, well, what are we going to do now? These people are unreliable. And then I just sort of said, let's just do politics, because quite frankly, politics is the new rock and roll, because there's no music that speaks for a generation anymore, because everybody's curating for themselves. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. There's no common experiences where people can say, this is the voice of a generation in music. And it's moved to politics, where people are, there's more common experience and common ground happening in politics. There's common ground, and then there's common ground with some people because of the people that you don't like. But comedy, or politics is the new rock and roll, and I just applied the same core of Much Music to politics, which is real people who are capable of expressing themselves well, have good personalities, are smart, who understand the business, understand what they're doing, what they're saying, and bring them together. And no paid pundits, no professional political, you know, proxies, none of those people that you see on mainstream TV always yelling at each other. And also, people couldn't yell at each other. There had to be a basis of respect and also a sense of humor, because I think you realize that you've lost perspective on an issue or on politics when you think nothing's funny, when you're not able to recognize there are some things that are absolutely absurd, mm-hmm. and some things that are funny because they're so horrible, sort of darkly funny. And we just, I took that recipe and applied it to politics the same way it was applied to music, and we did well. I mean, we thought we'd start quietly and, work, do a soft launch and work the bugs out. But the day we launched, we were in the top 20 on iTunes Canada's politics chart. 10 days later, we were top 5, mm-hmm. beating out CBC and Global and all these others. And then they started a new category called Politics and Culture, where we were number 1. And we currently get about between 10 and 12,000 downloads a month. And the rule of thumb, supposedly, is that there's more people, there's three times as many people, roughly, streaming than there are people downloading. So if you look at that, we're getting in excess of, 40, 45,000 people listening per month to our podcasts. So obviously we weren't able to sneak on, but I'm not complaining about the results. And now we're moving over to FU Music, which is, we're working very hard now. I've found new VJs to represent different types of music. They're all really, really talented people. And I'm very excited, and it's going to be different than Much Music was, in the sense that each single video is going to be its own show, with wraparounds and stuff like that, and possibly some talking over top. And we're only going to be using, initially, independent Canadian artists, people who either aren't signed to record labels or are signed to small record labels. Because the big guys, I don't know, it almost feels like selling out, including the big guys. So I want to start with the small, the smaller people who need a boost, mm-hmm. rather than just, coasting on Kanye West or whoever happens to be popular at the time. Those people kind of make me ill, because they're just so heavily marketed, and they just feel like cotton candy. After you've eaten it, you just feel sick and wonder why you did it. It seemed nice and sugary, and it seemed like a nice, bright, pink little treat, and then you eat it, and you're like, why did I do that? That's what I feel like with modern, mainstream pop culture, music, mm-hmm. and so on. So we've got some good stuff. I mean, Ben Rayner, who was at the Toronto Star for 22 years, last man standing, so to speak, in music reviews and so on, music journalism. He's on one of our shows with Eric Alper, who's a longtime music publicist and agent, and and with Ed the Sock, examining issues, and there's going to be more. And the VJs I mentioned are from across the country, literally. Some are in Vancouver, some are in Inuvik. It doesn't matter where you are anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be in a place. We don't need a much music environment because the entire world is our stage, so to speak.
Where do you see Canadian politics heading moving forward, especially after COVID?
Where do I see Canadian politics going in the future? I think that the Conservatives have shot themselves in the foot over and over and over again, and then put that foot in their mouth during this COVID period, because Canadians don't feel... I can't imagine Canadians feel like the Conservatives are on their side when Conservatives are out there saying they'd rather the good people starve or lose their homes because there may be some people who are cheating the system, even though there's measures in place to catch them on the back end if they're cheating. And they're calling Canadians basically, by and large, dishonest and so on. That's not a way to win the hearts and minds of people, especially people who are in a desperate time and desperate situation, and the government is offering a life raft, and the Conservatives are saying, don't offer them the raft, they can swim. So I think that what we're going to see, I think what's likely going to happen is, if an election were held tomorrow, I believe the Liberals will be returned with another majority, because Trudeau has been handling this quite well, and the Conservative attacks against him have been empty and weak and easily taken apart. I think the NDP will probably lose some seats, because they've been unimpressive. And how do I think the world is going to change, on a bigger picture? I think that it will be a while until people are comfortable going into movie theaters and concerts and things of that nature, sports arenas. So there's going to be some readjustment there. I mean, those businesses are going to be in trouble for a while. But I think that largely when it's safe to go out, whether it's a vaccine or a treatment program that's effective, we're going to see something. People will be slow to, congregate initially, but I think that will not be very long. I think that what we're going to see is kind of a mixture of the 70s and the 80s. The 70s, in that I think there's going to be a lot of hedonism. There's going to be a lot of people wanting to party because they've been, sacrificing and feeling like they've been sacrificing, mm-hmm. and enduring forms of privation for so long. They're going to want to reward themselves. They're going to want to, contents under pressure will explode. So I think we're going to see some of that. We're also going to see a hell of a lot of consumerism, I think, because people who have denied themselves things for a long time are going to want to give themselves a treat. So while I don't see things like durable goods, such as, dishwashers and fridges and stoves and stuff like that being major ticket items that are going to go crazy, I think if you come up with novelty items, things that are less important, that certainly aren't essentials, people are going to be wanting to buy things that aren't essentials because they're going to want to treat themselves to something that feels frivolous because it feels good to do something frivolous for a change. So I think that's what's going to happen. There will be some changes in that. I think that we're going to see people continuing to do lots of these shows on Zoom or wherever else, mm-hmm. For better or for worse. And I think that there are some people who, while they'll spend on some stuff that's frivolous, they'll know it's frivolous. And I think that a lot of people are going to be reconsidering some of the things that they had paid for previously or ways they lived their life previously that they now think, I don't really need to. And I think that businesses have discovered that they don't really need to have people in their offices. I think that one of the big changes we're going to see that's going to be permanent is people working from home more often. Because why should a business pay for overhead when the overhead can be borne by your employee in their own home? Maybe you have a workplace where people come together for meetings. Maybe, occasionally you want to have people who are working together get to meet each other in person. But I think there'll be a whole lot more people working from home than there were before. I think that will be something that changes for good when it all changes.
And just my last question, what's coming up for you?
Well, coming up for me is FU Music and continuing FU Politics. FU Music is going to be, videos. It's not going to be just audio podcasts. So there's that. And we're moving to video with a lot of our political programs as well. And we're going out getting advertisers. And we're adding, new programs all the time. you know, we have to wait till people are advertising again, then we want to go out and get them because we've got the numbers now to be able to satisfy, well, who's listening? Well, here's who's listening. I'm hoping that when 22 Minutes on CBC gets a new season and starts shooting, they've indicated that they'd like Ed to be back again doing streeters. We did that on Election Day. They flew me out, and Ed did stuff with people on Election Day out in Halifax and then was on the show itself, like on the set, and then did something with about Wexit a week later in Toronto. And they really like Ed on the street, so we're talking about doing more of those and maybe having Ed do some of his editorials as well. We'll see how it comes together, but CBC's 22 Minutes is the only Canadian show that isn't terrified of having Ed on, because Canadian broadcasters are terrified of Ed, because Ed has his own following, Ed has his own defined personality, and they like control, and they like to produce things that aren't going to bother anybody, and Ed bothers everybody and nobody at the same time. It's funny. All the time we did that controversial, supposedly late night show with the hot tub and the go-go dancers, we only had three complaints. One was completely dismissed out of hand. Two were sent to the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. One we were found to be in breach of, but we still disagree with that because there was another example at the same time that was found to be okay, and it was far, far worse. Mm-hmm. But all that mattered, all that we had to do was put a 20-second statement up before one of the shows, and that was it. So, only in Canada can you be too popular for television, which is what I was told by people who are running networks. You're too popular for us. Your brand is too strong for us. Only in Canada can that happen. So just keep your eyes open. There'll be a lot more stuff coming and a lot more stuff in video. We're just going to keep building.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. And if you did, please give a rating and review. You can reach me at craig@canadaehx.com. And you can also find hundreds of articles on Canada's history by going to my website. Go to canadaehx.com. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.